Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record Program Number 621, Interview with Paris Flamand about the Masks of New Orleans, Part 2. This is being recorded on January 20th of the year 2008, and once again, it is my pleasure and privilege to bring back to our airwaves Paris Flamand, the author of the 1969 book The Kennedy Conspiracy, published in hardcover by the Meredith Press, and the recently published four-volume magnum opus, The Assassination of America, about which Paris will tell you more later in the program. Paris also was the producer of the Long John Nebel Show, and no one who has been involved in talk radio in any capacity in this country in the last 50 or so years, there's no one who does not owe a debt to Long John Nebel. Paris, tell us a little bit about Long John Nebel, whom I grew up listening to, and Long John Nebel also was contacted about a prospective radio interview by a certain alleged leftist operating behind one of the masks with a Q of New Orleans.
Yes, that is one of the more interesting aspects of the entire thing for me, and I can't say it was a motivating factor because I was interested in doing the book anyway, because my publisher had responded positively to the idea of a book on John. However, I should say Jim. I'm confusing my celebrities. So one afternoon, I had stepped out of the office, and so the telephone call that came in was taken by John himself, which was not customary. I normally did the receiving of any inquiry calls.
By the way, we should clarify, John is Long John Nebel, the host of the Long John Nebel Show.
Go ahead. That is true, and we were at station WOR in New York City. And at that time, John had an all-night, five-hour show, which was sort of the foundation of all the talk shows that followed. In any event, he received this call, and it was from a young man in New Orleans who suggested that he was very interesting, and he was politically au courant and would like to come up and talk about his experiences in his trip to Russia and his political opinions and so on and so forth. He then noted that it would be necessary, because of his own financial situation, for the station to pay for his train fare or plane fare up to the city and whatever accommodations, overnight accommodations, could be provided. John explained that we did not offer traveling expenses, and we did not pay for accommodations, hotel accommodations. That was just not the policy of the show. And in point of fact, it was a perfectly logical one, since the vast majority of our guests were from New York or the New York area. The young man expressed his regrets and said he wasn't able to make the trip on his own. And John did remember, just because it was his general practice not to have anonymous calls, to ask him what his name was. And he said, my name is Lee Harvey Oswald, with a rather strong southern accent. And that was before, of course, either John or myself had the faintest idea that history would be made within a couple of months, and that, and I certainly didn't realize that I would become, a couple of years later, completely involved in the case.
In terms of time frame, now, this call to Long John Nebel from Lee Harvey Oswald came in August of 1963, in the same month that the WDSU interview was conducted. That is the interview that listeners heard on Side 1.
He doubtless was looking for an outlet for his comments and his opinion. Incidentally, I would just say, bracketing, that we got calls like that not uncommonly. George Lincoln Rockwell also called and wanted to be on the show, and for entirely different reasons. He was paying his own expenses and so on and so forth, but John was one of the three times that I remember John rejecting something, not because it wasn't a good show, but just on principle. He wouldn't have him on the air.
By the way, George Lincoln Rockwell was the Brown University-educated Führer of the American Nazi Party. His Arlington, Virginia name, address, and telephone number number were in the address book of the supposed communist Lee Harvey Oswald, whom you heard in side one, along with the Arlington, Virginia, or with the address, phone number, and so forth of another American Nazi Party member. Again, Oswald, the supposed commie. That party member was a fellow named Burroughs. I believe his first name was Daniel Burroughs.
Daniel Burroughs, yes.
And he became, of course, Rockwell was shot to death about the same time that Garrison's investigation was gathering steam, and Burroughs became a three-bullet suicide at the home of Roy Frankhauser, the Grand Dragon the Imperial Wizard, the head of the Pennsylvania Klan, and himself a CIA contract agent. And again, that was a three-bullet suicide. Paris.
I did want to bounce back into that connection, and I'm glad that you did. It is covered in, I believe it's volume two of the Assassination of America.
Mm-hmm. Yep, because it's interesting to see how many of these people track through some of the same territory. And there really could be, in a sense, no better jumping off point for the discussion of the masks. And again, by the way, for people that are listening, that's M-A-S-Q-U-E-S. It's a theatrical reference. And indeed, when we're talking about Lee Harvey Oswald, the commie, that is the mask that was held up, the audio mask that was held up via the WDSU radio interview, Conversation Carte Blanche. That interview was aired all over the United States on the evening of November 22nd, 1963, as perhaps an interview with Long John Nebel might have been, and everybody heard Oswald the Communist. Yet that's Oswald the Communist who had the Führer of the American Nazi Party's address in his book, and it's also Oswald the Communist who was the only member of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee in New Orleans. Tell us about those masks, Paris, and who lay behind them.
Well, there's that particular aspect, that facet, is of a special interest to the serious student, because among the intricacies of the machinations, on August 5th, 1963, Oswald visited the Casa Roca, which was a clothing store managed by Carlos Riñera. He was a Cuban exile leader in New Orleans, and Oswald offered to train some of his expatriated local countrymen in military practices. However, within a few days, Brignard found himself very confused and even incensed because he saw Oswald on Canal Street handing out pro-Castro pamphlets and promoting Fair Play for Cuba literature. They got in what became a famous fight and were arrested, released shortly thereafter. 2 weeks later, August 16th, Oswald was at it again before the International Trademark, handing out Fair Play for Cuba literature. 5 days after that, he engaged Brignard and Ed Butler, whom you have alluded to several times, of the Information Council of America, in a radio debate. So that circle of was he or wasn't he with Oswald, sometimes being clearly a anti-Castroite, and other times being even more apparently pro-Cuba, pro-Castro, is one of the most interesting subplots of the entire case.
The Fair Play for Cuba Committee. Now, in our last interview about the masks of New Orleans, Part 1, we talked about Bannister, and we also talked about the fact that he not only was not a leftist, bear in mind that the Fair Play for Cuba Committee had Bannister's detective agency's address as its mailing address, but tell us about Guy Bannister, his detective agency, and what really was the foundation for Lee Harvey Oswald's, quote, Fair Play for Cuba Committee, because that interview that people heard in side one was played all over the United States, but it was a mask that was being held up to shield the real Lee Harvey Oswald from the public, and instead a fictional portrayal of the events was held up on the media stage.
Well, the Fair Play for Cuba Committee itself may have been, as you put it, more nor less than a mask, because it is highly probable it had only one member, Oswald. There is Some effort has been made to associate one or two other figures with it, but it seems highly improbable. It was probably just a device he used to further whatever his objectives were at the time. Perry Russo, one of the major figures in Garrison's investigation, once said that Bannister's office was also the office of the INCA, I-N-C-A, which we mentioned before, the Information Council of America. And then Garrison was prone to note, down the street was the office of the CIA in New Orleans. Practically across the street was the office of the FBI. A few doors away was the office of the Naval Intelligence. And so within about a block, you had half the intelligence agencies in the United States, and all curiously located in New Orleans. That is not to say, of course, there weren't other offices in other cities. But in New Orleans, it seemed to that they found it convenient to function in this considerable congestion, and that congestion was all around Guy Bannister's office. Now, Guy Bannister, as you know, was the next FBI man. He had been with the New Orleans police, but left under shady or questionable circumstances. He was almost certainly an arms conveyor, if not dealer. Certainly, we know that there were witnesses who saw cases of armaments in his offices, for instance, hand grenades. He himself was apparently almost ruthless man, very violent, prone to be very physical when he'd had a drink or two, and he practically annihilated a alleged friend of his, one Jack Martin, who was a sometimes operative for his detective agency. Beat him so badly, almost put him in the hospital. So Bannister was someone who should be thoroughly looked into by anyone who's interested in the case, because in New Orleans, he was among the half dozen most important personalities to be related to the assassination probe.
And as you point out in your book, and as you've just alluded to, he not only was very active in the anti-Castro programs being executed literally at that point by elements of the intelligence community, but he was a virulent and violent anti-communist. So having the Fair Play for Cuba Committee's return address being Guy Bannister's detective agency, and of course the apparently lone member of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee in New Orleans being none other than Lee Harvey Oswald, is indeed, as you pointed out, a mask. Paris, one of the things...
Let me just interrupt you just for a moment and to make certain that it is clear to the audience that Oswald, beyond any doubt, spent a considerable amount of time in Bannister's office, met people there. It was served as a mail drop for him on occasion. And all of this by the man who, on one hand, is allegedly a pro-communist, and sometimes anti-communist, with a man who was ruthless, violent, and almost pathologically anti-communist. A strange pairing of people.
And these are the people who basically were the producers of the passion play, I guess one could say, that we saw, we listened to on side one, that radio play, in which Lee Harvey Oswald basically is portrayed as a communist. And yet remember that he says he was at all times under the protection of the U.S. government while in the Soviet Union, then backtracks. In response to a query about the status of his citizenship and patriotism, he says, well, the obvious answer is I'm back in the country. And note that Carlos Bringuier, associated with the anti-Castro Cuban effort, says in his address of such and such, Fidel Castro called President Kennedy a ruffian, a thief, Do you agree with Mr. Castro, thereby setting up Oswald as a possible actively hostile person to Kennedy? But those were just masks, and you've helped to unmask Lee Harvey Oswald. Please stand up in the television parlance of this time period.
You're alluding to another of the masks, because also in one of the books I have replicated a letter from Castro sent sotto voce, as it were, to Kennedy, saying, in effect, I understand why you have to say all the bad things about me, that it's politically expedient for you to do so. However, I am inviting a conversation that will resolve the difficulties and the disparities between your policies and mine. So the mysteries are interminable. Here you have Castro on one side, obviously a great enemy of Kennedy. On the other hand, through Lisa Howard, who apparently was acting as an agent for the United States government a good bit of the time that she was a reporter, sending a message, a conciliatory message to Kennedy. So these masks, as you correctly denote them, are interminable and essentially it's essential they be understood if one is going to grasp what the machinations of the entire case is or were and still are.
Paris, in our last interview about the masks of New Orleans, we mentioned how David Ferry, in turn, links up with Guy Bannister. David Ferry was the initial and primary focal point of Jim Garrison's investigation. What I'd like to do in the last several minutes, and perhaps this is too tall an order given the limited time, but arguably the dominant element in holding the masks up to the characters and perpetuating the dramatic fiction about Kennedy's assassination, which has come to be accepted as history, however demonstrably incorrect it is, are the media. I wonder if you could tell us about how the media have handled Jim Garrison's investigation, perhaps starting with Walter Sheridan and NBC, and then on up through the years, if time permits, some of your own firsthand experiences with the active suppression by supposedly independent media voices.
Well, you're right in citing Sheridan, because he was, if not the leader of the anti-Garrison cult, he was certainly one of the most venomous proponents. He did everything possible to destroy Garrison's investigation, including using his considerable influence as a highly placed individual in the NBC News. To destroy the methodology of the investigation, and of course he was slanderous in his comments about Russo. As a matter of fact, I'm sure it's that would be the end of book two. I've spent I think about 15 pages deciphering his motivations and explaining precisely what it was he did. I did personally understand and could respond to what was going on with him and various other people that were following his lead, people like Richard Townley, for instance, of NBC down in New Orleans, James Phelan, who wrote for the Saturday Evening Post. And there were simply one after the other individuals who were, without reason and without evidence, castigating the investigation Jim was attempting to continue. I myself underwent a similar but infinitely less venomous experience. I was appearing with Johnny Carson on Long John Neville show, and Johnny was disparaging Jim and saying to a great extent that he was simply a four-flusher and he had nothing, had no case at all. And I said, well, that's, you know, simply not true. I've recently come back from New Orleans and I've heard his case and I know exactly how effective it's going to be. He was speaking of the, at that point, the trial of the upcoming trial of Clay Shaw. And his adamant attitude was that there will never be a trial of Clay Shaw. There is no evidence against him, and it simply is propaganda and of a case that will never come to court. And I assured him that it would, and suggested that we make a bet that I would give him a signed copy of the book if the trial did not come off, and he would have me on his television show to discuss the case if it did happen. Well, of course, it did happen, and he welched on the bet, and Variety carried a full double column in the issue that followed the time when I was supposed to appear with all the exchange, the dialogue that established that a bet had been made and that he had reneged on it. His, by the way, excuse was he didn't pick the guests, his producer did. Well, I can tell you, having spent years in broadcasting, when a man is a star, he picks or vetoes all of the guests. So it was obviously a flat-out lie.
Perhaps he should have renamed his broadcast the Not Tonight Show.
Yes. Yes.
The criticisms, that's a really small term. The vicious attacks and fallacious attacks on Garrison were conducted almost from the get-go, and even the famous gray lady, although it's worth reading, the New York Times has been known to throw a curve or two, are among those institutions that have attacked Garrison's credibility. And perhaps, Paris, in the last few minutes that we've got here, you might allude to some of the people who, after the Oliver Stone film JFK, pranced right in on their heels, people like Gerald Posner and others who have been reinforcing the untenable official orthodoxy.
Well, there have been several. Of course, Posner and... remind me, the one who did the 1,800-page book. His name has simply slipped my mind. But anyway, Posner and Bugalesi, are the two prime defenders of the Warren Commission report, and reviews of them, especially of Posner, one by Jim DiEugenio, which I include in the final volume of the book, is just brilliant analysis.
By the way, Paris,
of all the flaws of the book. Incidentally, he and several other people have pointed out that there are more than 100 factual errors in Posner's book. So that's a bit much to have been merely errata. And of course, David Rohn is another person who wrote on Posner's book, and it was also analytically very good. I'm particularly fond of Josiah Thompson's book on Bugliosi, because Thompson himself has such an extremely high reputation as a assassinating critic. Certainly he'd be probably listed in any dozen of the entire history of the case.
By the way, Jim DiEugenio's Destiny Betrayed is a good overview of the Garrison investigation. Continue, Paris.
Superb. Fonzie, Gayton Fonzie, who was with the House Assassination Committee, is another person who has dismantled Bogliosi's contentions and arguments. Gary Aguilar, who, of course, is, as you know, is a physician, has also done the same to Bogliosi's book. So the number of instances where his work, which, by the way, I keep having pointed out to me, was at least to a great extent done by one, two, or three other people, although he may have done a rewrite of their notes, what have you. But that is just one of the things that is bantered about the Internet, and I have no idea whether he did actually sit down and type it out himself or whether it was the work of research assistants. In any event, the work has been completely demolished as any serious study of the case, and Posner even more. So there are people who have had doubts and who have written with some skepticism about certain aspects of the case, but in general, the recent Warren Commission things simply haven't been very good. For instance, F. Stein was not a complete acceptor of everything that was said or even everything that Jim said. He was quite critical at times, and yet he is a scholar, a very good writer, and one can pay attention to what he has to say even if one doesn't agree with him. Of course, you want to talk about medical things, you'd simply go to Cyril Wecht, who is overwhelmingly more qualified to discuss them than anybody else, and he leaves no doubt at all that the Warren Commission medical comments are untenable in the extreme. So it just goes on and on. The opposition, which means the opposition to the truth, will not prevail, but it will be the object of people who have some axe to grind. Either they get paid a great deal of money to do it, which is my understanding about one of the people who has written recently, in the last few years, on the assassination in favor of the Warren Commission, or they have some other objective. Mainly, they just want to believe a thing that is phantasmal. There are so many things. All one has to do is.
Paris, we are out of time. Excuse me. I'm gonna butt in here. We're gonna have to edit at this point ever so slightly, simply due to the inexorable limitations of time. What I'm gonna do is just kind of jump in, and we're gonna edit out a little bit here. But I'm gonna butt in very quickly. And so, Eric, give us a countdown. This is our edit point.
Just take it.
Okay, go ahead. Paris, we are all out of time. There's an old Turkish proverb: "He who tells the truth gets chased out of nine villages." When people are interested in the Kennedy assassination have been chased out of enough villages to suit them, they might want to refer to your four-volume magnum opus. Real quick, tell them how to get it.
Wild Plum, WILDPLUM at epix.net, or Assassination of America, all lowercase, no spaces, assassinationofamerica.com. And you will get a response within 24 hours.
So if you want to remove the masks from the dramatis personae in New Orleans and for some of the dramas that have occurred on the political stage since then, no better place to do it. We've been visiting with Paris Flamand, the author of The Kennedy Conspiracy, for the four-volume Assassination of America, and the former producer of The Long John Nebel Show. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record 621, interview with Paris Flamand about the Mask of New Orleans, Part 2, being recorded on January 20th of 2008. For Paris Flamand, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.